Welcome to Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast. My name is Ed Charbonneau. I am an artist whose main focus is on painting, and I am also an adjunct faculty member in the Fine Arts Department at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. This podcast presents a series of conversations about color, color usage, and optics as they relate to theories of human color perception in the making of visual art and design. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast. I'm delighted that we have as a guest today, Dr. David Briggs. Dr. David Briggs has been teaching classes on color for more than 20 years and currently teaches color, drawing, and painting at the National Art School and University of Technology, both in Sydney, Australia. His publications include a chapter on color spaces in the Routledge Handbook of Philosophy of Color, which was published in 2020. He also has a two-part paper on the elements of color in the Journal of International Color Association, which was published this year in 2023. And he has also authored various conference papers and recorded presentations. He has two outreach websites, one which is called The Dimensions of Color, which is at www.huevaluechroma.com. And the other website is Color Online, which is a Google site. And I will post those websites in the show notes of this podcast if people would like to look at these websites. They're very extensive, chock-a-blocked with information. David is past president, vice president, and the New South Wales division chair of the Color Society of Australia. He's the co-chair of the AIC study group on arts and design and is a committee member of the AIC/ISCC Color Literacy Project. His courses open to the public include an 8-week online course titled Understanding and Applying Color and various on-campus courses, all offered by the National Art School of Sydney, or in Sydney, I should say. And I should add here that I attended David's online course, the Understanding and Applying Color course, this past term, which I believe ran from August through September. It was like 8 weeks. But you added a 9th week because we weren't moving around along fast enough. So David graciously, generously added a 9th session. And the way it worked for me, I was in the United States. I'm in St. Louis Park, which is near Minneapolis. I got online at 7 p.m. and I believe it was like 10 a.m. your time or 11?
10, that's right.
10 o'clock, yeah. So it worked out pretty well as far as like the time zones. And I should say I was on Sunday nights, and for David and the people in Australia, it was on Monday mornings for them. For our interview today, we thought that we would discuss the class and discuss, ask David about where he comes from and what his interests are and background. And does that sound like a good plan, David?
But I think so. Yeah, I think because it's a bit of a long story, but I think it's the story of how I became interested in different aspects of color. So yeah, I think taking it that way would be good.
Yeah, because it seems like you've been on quite a journey. Because your website, when people go to look at it, it's like an encyclopedia of information. So it really speaks to the decades of work. So maybe I could just start off with a very basic question of how did color theory become a focus of your research and teaching?
Well, thanks, Ed. Well, I originally studied science. I've actually got a PhD in geology. in paleontology. But after I finished the PhD, I became obsessed with drawing and painting, and I went to study at a little art school in Sydney called the Julian Ashton Art School, the oldest continuous art school. It's great. It was sort of a school that focused on drawing and painting skills, sort of like the American ateliers, but completely separate lineage. Going back to the 1890s, Julian Ashton studied in Paris and taught here and taught various major Australian artists. So I got a really good practical education there. But the one thing that I thought could have been covered better was colour. And, you know, having said that, there were some individual teachers, Ian Chapman and Peter Doherty in particular, who had definitely taught different aspects, especially to do about light and the logic of light and that sort of thing. There's sort of a feeling with a more general feeling that colour was subjective and it couldn't be taught. So I thought, no, there's got to be more to it than that. And I've been teaching life drawing for a few years there. And I asked the principal if I could teach a colour workshop, a five-day colour workshop based on the little I knew then. He very kindly let me, and I kept doing them up to four times a year, right up until the school shut down temporarily with COVID. But since then, I've continued that as the online course through the National Art School, and it's still running as that. Yeah, so that was really through teaching that I learned, you know, had my first understandings of colour. And then I guess the next landmark, I was also teaching at a graphic design school called Billy Blue, and one of the multimedia teachers, Dave Agius, was looking for projects for his second year multimedia students. So he offered to make a website for me if I could write up the material and make the illustrations. And so that's how Your Value Chroma was born, titled The Dimensions of Colour.
So that was
I haven't changed the basic look of it from what the second year students did in 2007, because I kind of, you know, I love what they did. I kept working on that for another 10 years or so, up to the last sort of updates that are really part of the site are from about 2017. But I've got a page of links to subsequent videos and presentations that I've done sort of towards the end of it there. Yeah, so that was, so I'd had sort of 7 years of teaching colour pretty regularly. And I think that's kind of what you need with colour. I think if you try to write anything less than after, you know, with less experience than that, it's likely to be pretty, you know, derivative of other people's work and sure. So I felt like you need about to produce something.
Put it into practice and work with students with the ideas and which things are resonating more, and kind of develop your own approach to it as opposed to just following.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And there's so much to colour that you've really got to, there's a lot to put together before you can tell your own story about it, I think.
Interesting.
But at that stage, what I was, the focus was the title Dimensions of Colours. It's to really try to reinforce a three-dimensional way of thinking of colour, thinking of colour relationships in a three-dimensional space. Initially, the hue, value, and chroma, to sort of think of that as rather than just a two-dimensional colour wheel sort of approach, to talk about different colour wheels, different hue circles for different purposes. So that was a big part of it. I also, I had a subtitle at that time, Colour Made Difficult, which is sort of half-jokingly referring to the fact that I was also trying to critique the red, yellow, blue model of colour, which was and still is prominent, but which I felt that the critiques being offered at that time were also a little dubious, either to say that primary colours don't exist, which is, well, you know, there is something, there are differences in the way paints of different hues behave. So if you just say primary colors don't exist, people are going to tend to not listen to you, or to say, for example, that, or to say that the real scientific primary colors are cyan, magenta, and yellow. And again, that's
right.
That's a dubious argument. So trying to present a more nuanced critique of that approach, and also other color myths at the time, like the, you know, don't use black and that sort of thing. So, and a few other misconceptions about spectral and diffuse reflection and stuff like that. So basically, yeah, I had a bunch of things that I wanted to say at that stage, and that was a start of, you know, reaching people, you know, outside of Australia, because quickly discovered that there were painters who were very much enthusiastic about the Munsell framework and using that as a framework, including some, you know, really great painters like Graydon Parrish and Richard Murdoch and people like that. James Gurney, his wonderful book, Colour and Light. And
I don't know that one. I'll have to get it.
Oh, that's still a classic, I'd say. And you know, unlike maybe a few people more recently, he was always very scrupulous in citing his sources, giving credit to my website as having been useful to him, and recommending it for further reading and so forth. So, you know, a bunch of other ways it sort of opened up, you know, opportunities for me. I got a 3-year job teaching an elective on the history of colour theory and practice at our National Art School then, 2009 to 2011. In order to teach that, I had to sort of expand my understanding in a whole bunch of different areas of historical pigments and historical colour theory and so forth.
It's a massive amount of information.
Yeah, well, sort of one thing leads to another. So it's having the website was definitely you know, led to a lot of different opportunities for sure. After that, I was getting sort of having email correspondence with, you know, all sorts of different people who are interested in colour. Quite an eminent philosopher, Mohan Mathen, and he suggested my name writing a chapter in the Routledge Handbook of Philosophy of Colour, and that was in 2015. So, and it took quite a few years to come out, but that got me sort of looking into the literature of the philosophy of colour, and sort of coming up with just a way of putting together what is known scientifically about colour in a way that a lot of philosophers have this idea that the scientific model of colour is incompatible with our everyday experience. And so just it's what's needed, just a way of talking about colour that sort of does make sense in terms of our experience, sort of showed that really Newton had provided us with that, you know, in showing that the colour we of a light is the way we perceive its overall balance of wavelengths. And in fact, modern colorimetry is really just embodying that. So have a philosophical way of talking about colour that's consistent with science and with everyday experience.
Right. Yeah. Because, well, like Aristotle writes about color in some
yes.
that I've encountered. So it goes, I mean, he's kind of the first, kind of like the source of a lot of, sorry, I'm distracting.
Aristotle is very interesting. And Plato says a bit about before him and some of the others, but it's hard to know what they really mean from literature. Anyway, you know, before that, that's quite fragmentary. Even Plato is quite hard to understand. The passages that talk about colour, but Aristotle's idea of colours as forming a linear sequence between white and black was
right.
Kind of the starting point of organising colour for sure.
Yeah. Of putting them in order, and then he tried to pair them with the other senses, try to find the dichotomies of, or was that part of why Newton equated them to sound, like how he formed the color wheel off of the 8 notes of an octave?
That could take us down another rabbit hole. And I think, but yes, they definitely both had parallels. Very strong parallels with music. Yeah, very strong. I've got a little bit on my website about Newton and why he might have done that. Because people don't necessarily appreciate that the spacing on Newton's circle is different to the spacing that he measured in the spectrum, and it's adjusted according to the analogy with a particular musical scale that he used. And it just so happens that adjustment puts the complementary colors more or less opposite each other.
Wow.
So just by coincidence, I think, quite surprising that he would make that rather bold analogy, really, in a scientific work.
Yeah, because he was the first person, like in the West, to put him into a circle.
He was the first person. To put the hues in a circle. There were sort of circles before that had black and white as part of the circle. You know, he was the first person to take black and white out of that circle and just show the hues as making a circuit. Yeah, which is amazing that it didn't occur to anyone before. There's a diagram about 100 years before by Aguilonius, and you know you can trace lines, arcs on that connect up the hues. Down the bottom, yeah. But no one thought of taking that off and making it a separate circle until Newton.
Yeah. His chart, if I remember correctly, it kind of looks like an upside down umbrella with points coming up.
That's the one. Yeah, with these graceful arcs. Yeah. Yep.
Interesting. Mm.
Yeah.
So the website was originally called Color Made Difficult.
Just as a little subtitle there.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing that's been a big part of my life in the last quite a few years now is the Color Society of Australia. And I was invited and elected to be the New South Wales chair in 2015. So the main job has been to organise initially face-to-face meetings, and then since COVID, mostly webinars with different colour speakers on all different aspects of colour, giving us talks. So not just painting, but all different aspects. Anything you think of, science and philosophy, and definitely art and so forth. And so, with help from the rest of the committee, especially in the last few years, it's meant we've sort of reached out to all sorts of really interesting people, you know, around the world and around Australia. So that's been really, really important. I've given some talks for your Inter-Society Colour Council, which is the equivalent and an older sister of the Colour Society of Australia. The Colour Society here goes back to about 86. Yours, I think, goes back to the 30s at some stage. I gave a webinar for them in 2018 for their International Colour Day event, which was a great honour of my approach to colour. And I was invited to speak at the Munsell Centennial Symposium, 100 years that Albert Munsell died in Boston in 2018. And that was a fantastic conference. I gave a presentation and a workshop as part of that, thanks to Maggie Maggio, chair of the Colour Literacy Project and director of the ISCC. So that was a big step as well to sort of speak at a international conference like that. And done a couple more since that when they've been on Zoom, the Milan 2021 and Toronto 2022. I gave talks for those two as well about different things.
Yeah, I attended in September of 22 the Inter-Society Colour Council Colour Literacy Project Forum number 6.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
That was great. So just for our listeners out there, I'll put links to all these on a web page devoted to this episode. And because there's like David is describing, there's a whole lot of people devoted to with these organizations, and they hold conferences and invite speakers. You know, one of the things that is super impressive for me is that they're not just really geared towards painters, you know, because like when I went to art school, the color theory was kind of taught like through the lens of painting, and that if you were doing other stuff, you know, it was mainly about color mixing. Yeah, these societies have a huge swath of speakers and stuff like that. So
yeah, and both the American one and the Colour Society of Australia, our webinars are free to listen to, so you don't have to be a member, you don't have to pay to listen to the webinars live, and we make the recordings available for a week or two after the event, and then everything is available to members if they through our website. So and it's not very expensive, especially for overseas people. There's a half rate to be a member. So, and we have a few of them selected ones on open, just free for everyone anyway.
Yeah, quite the accomplishments and really interesting.
Then maybe the last thing to mention is the Colour Literacy Project. So that started up after UNSL 2018. And so that's involved talking on Zoom and communicating by emails with the committee of a dozen or so very experienced colour educators from all around the world, well, from, you know, the USA, Canada, Europe and UK. And so that's some very, very experienced teachers in the group. And it's helped me to sort of, you know, just to see a group who have got a lot of experience about colour, but maybe there it makes us realise that there are some things that still haven't got through to everyone. Particularly, the thing that I've been very interested in is these dimensions of colour, which are not just the familiar three dimensions, the hue, value, and chroma, but the other standard ones, the lightness, brightness, colourfulness, and saturation, and how they relate, things like that. Various things that I've you know, had some trouble explaining or convincing other people about within the group. I've gone off and written a couple of papers to get those points across, you know, to generally, because it's I think they're for various reasons, that sort of standard terminology that was really sort of nailed down beautifully in the 70s and 80s hasn't sort of hadn't filtered through the colour world generally. And
right.
So that's sort of been the origin of those two papers in the journal.
Yeah, because brightness and value are not necessarily the same thing.
Oh no, that's good. You're a very good student, Ed.
But it is complicated to keep them, to think of them separately, which was great about taking your class. And so, like the Color Literacy Project, I know a little bit about them, and I met one of the members last year around this time. We had a Zoom call. Super interesting. So the goal of that group is it essentially, like with the word literacy in the title, the mission to build a collection of current knowledge that can be shared with educators, that can be to create this literacy that is more nuanced than, you know, red, yellow, and blue are primaries, or no, wait, it's cyan, yellow, and magenta, or wait, maybe it's red, green, and blue. And because it seems to me, as I've learned, as I've been studying, there are no real formulas that work 100% of the time. And so to like think of these subtle nuances, and am I increasing my literacy of the various principles that are out there, so is that kind of the mission of the group?
I wouldn't say it's to sort of it's to build a reference to the most basic concepts. It's definitely to sort of fight against sort of what they call the rehash of the that's always the same, you know, primary colors, secondary colors, tertiary colors, color harmony, or this rehash, and to definitely encourage a more experiential approach to color education. So beginning with exercises rather than color wheels, for example, a lot of the focus has been on teaching very young students, like primary school students, which was you know really quite different to my focus and my motivations in joining it. I was more interested in getting across brightness, lightness, saturation, and sort of the things that are actually quite basic, but you know not very well understood, not very generally understood. So I was more interested in sort of getting across the those things, which is what I talked about in my talk in Boston. But yeah, aside from that part of what they're doing, but that's a big part of what they're doing is coming up with a great program of exercises for teaching primary school students, for teachers of primary school students, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, a colleague of mine made a comment years ago that kind of stuck with me is when young children take music lessons, they work on the scales, they have all of this stuff. Whereas I remember art class was basically throw a bunch of crayons on the table and, you know, you're going to color. And there, you know what I mean? And there wasn't any kind of structure to it that I recall. I've thought about that myself. Yeah, like even Crayola, you know, could they, you know, just in the organization of colors in the box could be the beginning of that teaching.
I think yeah, starting with perception, starting with sort of experiments in visual perception is really I think that's a good, very positive aspect of what they're doing.
Yeah, like getting lights out and playing around with lights.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a different access point to color and thinking about it rather than just green, you know, trees are green and the sky is blue. And fascinating. Well, all right. We've made it through your history of what has brought us to today. So the class, yes, Understanding and Applying Color, it's divided into 8 sections, and each section has a theme. Topic. So is that the culmination of all of this? Because I remember you did have a history section. You spent a day talking about brightness, colorfulness, and what was the third one? I guess I wasn't such a good student.
Saturation.
Yeah, saturation.
We did that a bit later, actually.
That was kind of towards the tail end of the course. And so the class, it seems to me, is an accumulation of and distilling of all this knowledge down into these 3-hour chunks. In as much as you can, you know, they're pretty action-packed classes. There's, you know, just to let the viewers know, like, David basically goes, it's 3 hours, and I, what do you take, like a 7-minute break for tea?
Just a cup of tea and back to it.
Yeah. An hour and a half, and then it's back on. So I highly recommend taking this class, but for sure have your notebook with you. The information just comes, but you provide a ton of resources as well.
Yeah, so there's about 500 slides from the PowerPoints, and there's a reason for that. I've always done it that way, tried to put a lot in, because basically I'm not assuming any prior knowledge, so I want to have people who might be just beginning with color, but I've also had world experts on color do the course as well, like yourself, and one of the people on the color literacy team so far has done it, and so, you know, and I can honestly say people at all those levels have enjoyed it, but the only way you can deal with that sort of range of prior experience is to you know, pack a lot in, give plenty, so there's something for everyone, and sort of highlight the important things for beginners, but, you know, have some insights that have been relatively new for me, for other. I think that the key is probably to get people to study the slides, you know, soon after the lecture and maybe even before the lecture, so that
right.
you can take more in. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, because you do have homework, but the homework is kind of optional.
That's right, because not everyone doing the course is interested in painting. You know, some are just interested in color as human perceivers, and I kind of hope that all of the students are like that. You know, that they're if someone was doing it who only wanted to know about color to help their painting, then they'd probably find about half the course boring, and half the other half would be really great. But I hope most of the students are fascinated by color just because we're human beings and we see it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good point about the amount of information. I always say when I'm working with a class, like if I'm going to lay out something that's like really complicated, I just tell people like, don't worry if you understand this or not, but like the next time you hear it, it won't be the first time. Because it's a process of learning and everything is so interconnected, which I loved about the whole thing. Like you said, it's not just artists who would benefit from this class per se, or that I would think would, it's not a prerequisite that you need to be an artist or a painter or whatever. Because you do talk a lot about perception. And what was the one thing that sticks with me is that bit about, well, like this notion that there's no color in the world and that it's the wavelengths that we perceive that our minds interpret as colors.
Yeah, or that balance of wavelengths, yeah.
That's balance of wavelengths, yeah, because it's sets of wavelengths. It's not just like one wavelength is going to give me a sensation of red. Well, you refer to it as like a bias of wavelengths.
Yes, yeah, that's
right. A bias towards red, but there is... Because I believe I've read that all objects reflect a certain portion of the entire spectrum. That they don't, a red car doesn't just reflect long wavelengths at us. But then you got into talking about refractive index, that pigments themselves, am I saying this right, recalling this correctly? The pigments themselves are actually clear.
That's right. That's something I didn't realize for a few years when I was teaching, is that apart from black, but all white and all colored pigments, they're actually on a microscopic level, they're transparent. But the things that make opaque pigments opaque is a high refractive index, so that the light gets bent and scattered more because they have a high refractive index compared to the oil medium or acrylic medium. If the refractive index is about the same as the medium, then the light goes straight through and they're transparent.
Straight through it. Right. And so, and then wasn't it like over time, the refractive index of the medium changes?
Well, with oils, yes, yes.
With oils. And it goes... Does it go up? I forget. So that eventually layers of paint become clear again.
Clearer. Yeah. That's clearer. Right. The refractive index steadily increases over decades and over centuries, and so it gets a little bit closer to the refractive index of those opaque pigments. And so the paint scatters light a bit less, and you can see through it a bit more, and all sorts of things start showing up in paintings, pentimenti, the things that the artist has changed.
A figure that they may have painted out in the background or something.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, and maybe it was painted in the 11th century, and now you can see a faint impression of that in some cases. The layers over it are becoming more clear as their refractive indices between the oil medium and the pigment itself become more equal.
That's it. Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe not 11 for oil paints, but yeah, going back to,
So that's a glimpse into like the level of complexity that it does get into, but it felt really accessible to me. Maybe because there's such a strong visual component.
Yeah. I think that's really important.
Examples of demonstrating these things and how light behaves and light and shadow and Well, and really even breaking down, well, I don't want to give away too much of the class, but even just breaking down how objects cast shadows and penundrum of the shadow, like the fuzzy part around a shadow, hers, and describing multiple light sources and how light bounces around into the underside of objects, which to me has always been like the key to making something look like it's volumetric, is getting that reflected light in the shadows to be just the right contrast so you can reach in there and look like you can just grab the ball or whatever. So yeah, very cool. Very nice. All right, well, this is great, David. Thank you so much for all of this. Maybe I'd like to wrap up our discussion by asking you, with all this research and understanding and experience with color and working with students and building this database and working with these societies, and you yourself are a painter, so maybe the question is, like, over the years, how have you seen this research impacting the decisions you're making while you're painting?
Okay. The funny thing is, you know, from a purely practical point of view, you know, the most useful things are really quite basic. I think the most useful thing that I, for myself and that I try to get across to students, is how useful it is to think in terms of a concrete value scale, such as the Munsell scale, to sort of plan your picture and think of the picture in terms of a you know, more or less nine value scale. It doesn't matter that the whole thing is a fudge. You know, if you look at how the Munsell system was sort of finally sorted, you can't make a value scale that looks exactly even irrespective of the background, so they just had to average the results for different things. It doesn't matter yeah, that it's kind of a fudge. It's a useful construct, enormously useful for painters. So thinking in terms of that grayscale, and then also using that framework of thinking of moving through hue, value, and chroma to quickly and efficiently match a color. And you know that exercise we did with the paint samples, and you know, is showing being able to sort of, you know, just very quickly by thinking of what you're doing as moving through hue, value, chroma space to get that color you want and get it again and again, you know, every time. Those two things are, I guess, the most important. If we have to pick two of them, and they're pretty basic. Yes. The color perception stuff comes in useful all the time, though, in solving sort of problems that you have in observing a scene and deciding what colors you want to match, want to make. Especially, it's remarkably difficult to compare brightness of different parts of a scene, you know, to compare the shadow side of an object with the light side of another object and see, are they the same, are they different? It's remarkably difficult because we've got the equipment to do it, but we're not used to using it that way. We're so focused on the colors of objects, it can blind us to the brightness of the light reaching our eyes. So understanding that and understanding ways of contending that would be another very important practically. And then, you know, after that, sort of the understanding the technical properties of paints and mixing paths of paints, the characteristic mixing paths of mixing with white, with black, with grey, with other with different hues of paints, that's very helpful to understand that and to be aware of the myths, the misconceptions that are floating around about that, you know, don't use black paint or so on. You'd include the red, yellow, blue primary color idea in that, but I'm not as sort of obsessed with that as some people are, because, you know, you can still, that's not an insurmountable problem. And there are some fantastic painters who think in terms of a red, yellow, blue So it's not, from a purely practical point of view, it's not such a massive problem as it might be made out to be. But it's the problem is that if you want to learn anything else about color, you sort of got to unlearn that way of
right. It's limiting of
red, yellow, and blue primaries. Yeah, it's and it can be just the thing is that sort of idea can be hard to dispel once it's got in there. Once it's right. inside.
Well, I remember one of the things, you know, going back to like don't use black. Well, actually, I remember when I was in school, I was told to never use the colors straight out of the tubes. Always do something with them to mix. And it dawned on me maybe a year or two after graduation, I was like, well, why would I automatically dispel the easiest colors there are to make? You know, you just kind of squeeze it out and it's there. Well, and then in the class too, you demonstrated how when you add white, if I'm paraphrasing you right, when you add white, you're adding short, medium, and long wavelengths to the mixture. So it's actually changing the hue, that the colors don't travel on mixing colors don't travel on a straight line through a mixing color space.
But that's, that's just quite a neat to show that, to show why it is. And it just helps you to sort of understand these spectral reflectance profiles, that they actually tell you something interesting, and you can sort of show why a pink color go more purplish when you add white to it. Why does a yellow paint become more greenish yellow when you add white to it, and so on. It all makes perfect sense if you reflectance profiles. Yeah.
The reflectance profiles, because it is just wavelengths that we're perceiving, and the balance of those wavelengths is shifting as you're changing the chemical makeup of the mixture. And it's not just you take yellow and blue and you get green. I mean, that's what happens, I guess, but it's a bit more complex in terms of being able to predict.
That's a key point, really, is that, you know, the yellow and the blue aren't actually in the paint. All right, the yellow and the blue are perceptions that are created in your mind, and so they're not actually in the paint, and they're not actually mixing out there in the world. And so that's why you can get, you know, you can mix a yellow and a blue light and get white, and you can mix a yellow and a blue paint and get green, and you could have yellow and blue dots viewed from, or spinning discs of yellow and blue, and get gray. And it's only a problem if you assume it's the colors that are mixing, but they're not. They're just three different processes that have three different results and have three different balances of wavelengths that you perceive as different colors. But it's not the yellow and the blue that are mixing.
They're not the culprits.
They're not the main actors, no.
Yeah, the main actors, yes. Well, that is, well, that was day one of the class.
That's right.
So kick the training wheels off right away and just go downhill on the bike. But it was really great, because I remember too, another student in the class kind of towards the end said something to the effect of, why am I just learning this now? How come, you know, like, what? You know, it makes so much sense into these histories. And just what you just said about the three different ways that the blue and the yellow are presented as mixing, that our perception does different things with those different situations. Mm-hmm. And that we quote unquote mix them in our minds to yield a color.
It's totally understandable, right? Like the colors look like they're in the paint, and so it's totally natural to assume that they're mixing in the paint, but that's not what's happening.
Well, yeah, and we'll put some of David's paintings on the website, and so that you can look at those. I think they're very much informed by what I remember with the class being about. I could see, as a painter myself, maybe like your mind at work with a couple of pieces that I've seen of yours and how it relates to the content. For our listeners out there of Chromosphere, the Color Theory podcast, which actually just clicked over to 29,000 downloads.
Wow.
And it's from people all over the world. Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast, is big in Australia, evidently.
Oh, well, great.
So for all of our listeners, the name of the class is Understanding and Applying Color. It's through the National Art School. Yeah, the National Art School of Australia, which is located in Sydney. It's an online course. There's no, how do I put it? I didn't have to fill out an application to take the class. You don't have to be accepted. I just signed up and paid my tuition and I was in. And not only is it the 8 weeks of class, but there's a ton of backup information and all the slides that David shows so that you can go back and revisit it, and then links to other material relevant to each day's course topics.
Yeah, that's right. There's no application because there's no prior knowledge assumed. The only thing that is I hope you have an interest in if you're fascinated by color itself as well as in terms of painting. I think it probably should just explain it. It's going to be offered four terms next year, but alternately in the mornings in Australia, which are good for the North America, North or South America, and alternating with the evenings here, which are terrible for the US, but good for Europe and the UK. So it's the first term and the third term that you'd be looking at. Term one, which is starting February 5th, and or term three, they're on the page for the class. And there is a limit of 12 students per class, and the bookings are open already for term one and two. So might be a good idea to enroll early. And there's even an early discount until the end of December for those ones. So.
Oh, great. Yeah, and then it looks like term three is July 22nd, and term four starts October 14th, so about this time of the year next year.
Yeah.
Well, great. And yeah, just as you were talking, like the stuff that you cover in the class, and you know, when I'm outside gardening and working on landscaping, because that's one of my hobbies, is I'm trying to get rid of all the grass in my yard. When we bought our house, we bought the house with the biggest yard, and it was all grass.
Oh.
So we're switching it over to when I'm planting, you know, and moving stuff around, it's like color theory in action out there, you know. So yes, you gardeners out there, maybe there's an access point there for you too. So just to kind of emphasize again, it's not just a painting thing. But anyway, well, very good. Well, thanks again for doing this, and I really appreciate it. And I look forward to what our next interaction might be, or I don't know where this is all leading. So stay in touch.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, and maybe you might see you at one of the Color Society webinars or something if you want to tune in for those.
Absolutely.
Great.
Cool.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share it with your friends and family who may be interested, and follow Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast, on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you if you have comments or suggestions. I'd like to thank Jeremy Shapinski for writing and performing the theme music. Thank you also to Grant Winkles, Susie Manili, and Jeremy Shapinski again for their production, consulting, and editing.